Good morning, everyone. Our reading today comes from 1 Samuel 3, 10 through 21. Then the Lord came and stood and called as the other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening. The Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." So Samuel lay down until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, but Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. Then Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "What is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you." So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words all Israel from Dan even to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
I appreciate that reading. We understand that what's going to happen to Eli's household from that reading, but I'd like to focus our attention this morning as to the why. Prior to God calling Samuel, actually he was calling all the time, but prior to what we read there in the 10th verse, Samuel thought that it was Eli calling him, when in all reality it was God calling him. And remember, we discussed last week that this Samuel is a boy, just a boy. So we find in the third chapter of 1 Samuel, we find this boy, Samuel, ministering before the Lord. And he's under the tutelage of Eli the priest. He's given a very, very difficult first task, and that is to express this prophecy about the household of Eli, and especially against his sons, whose names are Hophni, and I'm going to say Phinehas. I don't know if that's how that's pronounced, but that's the way I'm going to pronounce it, Phinehas. As we study this story, I think it's important for us to dissect the circumstances that have led up to such a harsh judgment for one of God's priests, his house of Eli. In this lesson, we want to look at what caused the downfall of Eli's sons. And I think we can see, which is an unusual title, and you may deem that an unusual title, but how God deals with worthless people. And it's an important lesson, I think, because we have a lot of worthless people really around us that will try to influence us to do wrong instead of doing good. So keep that in mind as we read this. If you go and you look at 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12, you'll see Hophni and Phinehas called worthless by the writer here. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Now, what is meant by the designation of worthless? The King James uses the word corrupt. The New American Standard uses the word useless. All three of these words have the same Hebrew word, or from the same Hebrew word that is translated Belial. It is often used in the phrase sons of Belial. Now, how does God deal with people that are the sons of Belial, or worthless men? I want to give a couple examples, and the first one comes from Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verses 12 through 15. If you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known. And I'm going to stop there just for a second so you understand. They're just not going to come outright to these people and say, let's go serve other gods after they've been serving the Lord. This is going to be done over time. It's going to be done in a sneaky way. It's going to be done in such a way that these people look like they're good and that they're righteous. But they'll be called worthless, and they are called worthless here. Verse 14, and you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. If it is true and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it and its cattle with the edge of the sword. Now here in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the words of God delivered by Moses informs the people to be aware of these worthless men who will try and seduce the men, the inhabitants of the city to worship other gods, and they will do this just as they've always done, posing as someone that's much like a prophet or someone that's much like someone that appears to be righteous. This situation really reminds me of what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15, where Jesus says, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. He's saying to avoid these men and to shun idolatry, those men in that city. He says, but if these worthless men, when you go to investigate, if they have possibly been convincing, and they convince God's people to serve and to worship other gods, he says, you get them, you kill them, every single person, you kill every animal, and you kill every living thing in that city. What was the cause? The cause of that is the devastation of these worthless men. Devastation caused by men that are deemed worthless. My second example is one that I think we're all aware of, and I can't possibly think of another person that I've known or I've read about in the Bible that is more worthless than the woman described as Jezebel in the Bible. Even her name causes disdain, even to this day, and contempt in the hearts of men and women when they hear it. Now I've heard of parents naming their children Cain, and you probably have too, though oftentimes when they name their child Cain, it's not spelled as the same way as it is in the Bible, but their name is Cain. We've seen that. But I have never heard in my lifetime anybody that's ever named their daughter Jezebel. Has anybody in here heard anybody ever name anybody Jezebel? Their daughter. I don't even think, probably, if you get that book of names where you're expecting to have a child, I can't imagine, and I haven't looked at one for a long time, but I can't imagine that the name Jezebel is even in that book. And maybe it is, but I can't imagine that it is. But here's a story about Jezebel. King Ahab was the husband of Jezebel. King Ahab was the king of Samaria. You can read about him and all the things that happened here, and I'm bringing it really concise, so you're going to have to go back and read some of this. But you can read it in 1 Kings. King Ahab's palace was situated right next to a vineyard that was owned by a man named Naboth. And Naboth must have been, he must have been a man with a green thumb. He's kind of like Gary. I was at Gary's house, and he's got a green thumb because he does a great job on all the vegetation and things that he has. I've never had a green thumb. Mine's black. Everything I ever touch usually dies. But Naboth must have had a green thumb because his land was very appealing to Ahab, and it was situated right next to him, and he coveted that property. Look at 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 2. It says, Ahab spoke to Naboth saying, give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden because it is close beside my house, and I will give you a better vineyard than it in its place. If you like, I will give you the price of it in money. Now, you know, we might hear a proposal like that in our day and we think, man, if he's willing to give me something even better, or he's willing to buy my property for such and such an amount, I might be able to get a lot more out of it. If he's really wanting it that bad, and we would say, oh, now where do I sign? But Naboth was different. Naboth did not want to sell his property. It was not only a land in which he earned a living, it had great sentimental value because it was a land of heritage. Look at verse 3 of that same chapter, chapter 21 of 1 Kings. But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. King Ahab, he went back home and he just literally pouted. He would turn his back to the wall on his bed. He faced the wall. Everybody seen his back, did not see his face. He wouldn't eat anything. He was just pouting. And why was that? Because he just wasn't accustomed to anybody telling him no. I think we have a whole generation of people today that are not used to people telling them no. And we see what happens sometimes when they are told no. It's hard to feel sorry for Ahab, though. If you look in that same chapter and you look at verse 25, it says here, surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. Jezebel hears his story. And since she is such a deviant character, she says to him, get up and act like the king. I'll get this land for you. It's good to have your spouse on your side. It really is. It's really good to have that person that you're with constantly to be on your side when you're going to do something. But I don't know if it was such a good thing to have Jezebel on your side, someone like that. Jezebel wrote letters to the leaders over Naboth as if she was writing like the king Ahab would be writing. And the letters call for them to declare a fast, a time of fasting. Basically, that was a time here that she intended for to purify any dissenters to the king, anybody that would object to what the king wanted. And this is what she had written here in verse 9 and 10. Now, she wrote in the letter saying, proclaim a fast and seat Naboth at the head of the people and seat two worthless men before him. And let them testify against him, saying, you curse God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. And that's exactly what happened. Naboth was stoned to death on the testimony of two worthless men. And they claimed that he had cursed God and the king. And after his death, King Ahab, he took claim of that land. King Ahab brought calamity to his own household because he coveted this land, this worthless deed he benefited from. One thing that we can take comfort from And I think we need to keep in mind how God deals with worthless people. It is how God deals with them. It's not our responsibility. It is God. God will reap the vengeance. But he didn't enjoy that land very long. King Ahab, if you remember, he met his fate on the battlefield. He tried to disguise himself on the battlefield so nobody would know that he was king. And he was getting away with it for the most part. And someone on the opposite side drew back an arrow and just shot it up in the air. And guess what? It got old King Ahab. So by chance, it killed him on the battlefield. Jezebel met her fate sometime after King Ahab did. And let's learn a little bit about that. Jehu, he was a captain in the Lord's army. He was under King Ahab. He was anointed as the king of Israel by Elisha, the prophet. Elisha came after Elijah. He was to go and strike the house of Ahab. That was his master's house. Now, Jezebel was a very important target for him. She was responsible, too, for the deaths of many of the Lord's prophets. In fact, she sought to put Elijah to death as well. Look at 2 Kings chapter 9 and look at verses 7 and 8. You shall strike the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab every male person, both bond and free, in Israel. And read down, just go past to verse 10. This is the prophecy about Jezebel. The dog shall eat Jezebel in the territory of Jezreel, and none shall bury her. How does God deal with a worthless person like Jezebel? Look at 2 Kings chapter 9 and verses 30 through 35. When Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. Now, I want you to keep in mind, Jezebel thinks that she's untouchable. She has been the king's wife. She is still in the palace. She still thinks she has friends in the palace. And she's going to poke fun of Jehu here. It says, Jezebel heard of it, and she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. As Jehu entered the gate, she said, is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer? Then he lifted up his face to the window and said, who is on my side? Who? And two or three officials looked down at him. Now, these are officials, you know, that were under the charge of King Ahab. Who are on my side? He said, throw her down. So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. Now, get the picture. She's up at a pretty high place looking down, and these two men probably didn't think much of her either. They grab her. They throw her out that window, and as she's falling a good distance, I'm sure her body, but particularly her head, would hit the walls of the palace, and it split her head open and her blood sprinkled, spattered all over the walls and on the horses that were down below, and he trampled her underfoot. When he came in, he ate and drank, this is Jehu, and he said, see now to this cursed woman and bury her, for she is the king's daughter. They went to bury her, but they found nothing more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. What do you suppose happened to her? Eaten by dogs. Eaten by the dogs. That's how God handles worthless people. From these two examples, I think we can see what classifies, what the Bible classifies as worthless people. I want to look a little bit deeper than that. Worthless, that is sometimes used as useless, wicked, good for nothing. people who, and you can see it today, people who are, who God would classify as useless, keep aware that we can see them resist Him over and over again. They constantly disrupt His ways, and they do their very best to pervert the truth under the guise of doing what's best for us, or under the guise of what's good and righteous, when in reality, they will be the detriment to us if we allow them to be. The Hebrew term which means Belial became associated with this word to the extent, that is the word useless or worthless, to the extent that it became a definitive characteristic of Satan himself, because he embodies everything that is worthless, because he is trying to corrupt the church. He's trying to corrupt you and me. He embodies everything that the Bible calls worthless. The true church is always being attacked by him. His tactics, in my opinion, and I believe it to be true, is why we have so many denominational churches today, and why we have a lot of different churches that have split from the true church. As for Hophni and Phinehas, the Bible tells us in chapter 2, about going back to 1 Samuel, talking about and describing their worthlessness, that they took more than they were allowed as Eli's servants under the priesthood. So what they would do, the priests were always provided for by the people. Their sustenance was provided for by the people, and they were allotted so much, but they were allotted of something in particular for their sustenance. But what they would do, and you can go back and read that chapter, and you probably should, but what they would do, the Hophni and Phinehas, they wanted a certain portion of meat that was cooking, and they were not allowed to have that. They were also not allowed to take raw meat. Whatever was their allotment, they wanted more. And these worthless men, when people would come to sacrifice, said, if you don't give it to us, we're going to take it by force. Now understand, these are the sons of the priest who is doing things on, you know, he is governing, he is watching over sacrifices, he is the mediator between the people and God. In 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 17, it says, thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. Now this wasn't their only great sin. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22, it says, now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. You know, when I was reading this and I was studying this and I was thinking to myself, I was giving consideration to the behavior of Eli's sons, I thought to myself, why are they getting away with this? Why isn't somebody standing up to them? Why isn't somebody doing something? And then it dawned on me, as I said, they're the sons of the priests. And I'm going to have to pause just a minute and get a drink here. The one that was their spokesman, Eli was a spokesman between them and God. He oversaw their sacrifices. He was their mediator. He was a very important and powerful man. So people, when they didn't say anything, they just felt like they had no choice. They just were stuck. As for Hophni and Phinehas, they used their father's position, his power, and authority to get away with their sin. And they lived lives that designated them as worthless. Listen to Eli's rebuke. As you remember, you heard Brother Larry read, God says that he's disappointed and he's going to judge Eli because he did not rebuke them. Now, next week we'll talk a little bit about this. But he did rebuke him, but that's not what God is saying, and that's not what God wanted. But listen to his rebuke. 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 25, it says, "If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. I think that's a very powerful statement that Eli made here. But the simple fact remains that Eli's sons knew exactly what they were doing, and they simply did not care. That's the reason they were called worthless. Worthless people are driven by what John says in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16. He says, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. Jesus says we will know worthless people, and we'll know all people. We'll know them by their fruits. Sometimes people seem harmless, and sometimes they appear to be righteous. And if we don't know the difference, then we could be taken by them. What can we take from this? I hope what we can take from this lesson. We have defined the term worthless as used in the Bible, and it's completely opposite what is holy. God calls us to be holy as he is holy. We've learned how God deals with worthless people. Can you think of a time where other worthless people were called to testify against someone?
Jesus
himself. Worthless people called against him, called out to testify against him. I don't know what happened to those worthless people, but if it's anything like this, and they didn't change, they didn't repent, then I got a pretty good idea what's going to happen to them. And the third thing I think that we can take from this is we need to avoid worthless people. We need to know what it means to be worthless. We don't want to be worthless, but we need to know what it means so that we can avoid them. They can have a tremendous influence on us and our lives. And unfortunately, so often, and it's really sad that the worthless people we have or the people that are in our lives are the people that we're close to. We have a relationship with them in one way or another. Sometimes it's our friends, and sometimes it's our family, and a lot of times it's our coworkers. We have no choice but to associate with them. But that doesn't mean we have to be influenced by them or we have to be like them. God wants us to be like him. He wants us to be holy. He wants us also to be aware. Jesus says, be aware, be aware. Have your eyes open. Be sober-minded. Know what's going on around you. And I think this is an important lesson that we learn. And then next week, hopefully, we'll look at Eli. And that's a deeper situation than we may give credence to, but it is a deep situation in Eli dealing with his sons. I'm going to draw this lesson to a close. It is yours to think about and ponder upon. Go back and read some of those things that we talked about. But we're going to offer Christ's invitation for anyone that's outside of Christ. If you have a desire to put on Christ through baptism, we want to help you do that. If you are in Christ, but you need the prayers of the faithful, you need the prayers of the church, you have an opportunity to come and let us know that. You don't have to come forward. If you are walking out of the building today and I'm standing there or one of the brethren are standing there, just let them know. Let Brother Tim know. You want to be baptized? You don't have to come forward. We'd like for you to, but if you don't, you want to be baptized, let Tim know, let me know. We'll make sure that happens. If you need prayer, let us know. We'll make sure that happens. We're gonna give you that opportunity while we stand and while we sing 783.